like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals. Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Eric Ristow, co-director of Sit, Stay, Ride, the story of America's sidecar dogs. Documentary about motorcyclists with sidecars and the dogs who ride in those sidecars. Part of the reason I wanted to speak with Ristow is that this movie, which might be expected to be merely an entertaining tour of a colorful subculture, blossoms into a surprisingly pointed film propelled by themes of freedom, joy, companionship, love, rescue, loyalty, kinship, and redemption. We'll delve into sidecar dogs, both the phenomenon and the film, in a few moments when I speak with Eric Ristow here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak briefly with Dr. Stephen Tauber, chair of the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida, who will be delivering a lecture in Tampa tonight entitled Law, Politics, and Animal Rights. Before we go any further, though, I want to thank everyone who supported Talking Animals and me in WMNF's winter membership drive. Talking Animals managed to travel well past its fundraising goal, so again, thank you. But the station fell a bit short of its overall goal for the fund drive, so if you didn't have a chance to donate, please do so at WMNF.org. For our opening animal song, we've been hearing Tampa's own, arguably WMNF's own, Stolen Idols with a piece called Monkey Mayhem. Let's turn it up and place it front and center again. This is Stolen Idols with Monkey Mayhem now on Talking Animals. That was Stolen Idols with Monkey Mayhem, a jazzy, soaring little animal song to get us to launch this morning. Let's move now into our conversation with Eric Risto about his documentary Sit, Stay, Ride, the story of America's sidecar dogs, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Eric Risto to Talking Animals. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Talking Animals.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks so much.
So there's a lot I'm hoping to cover here because, as I suggested in an email to you yesterday, the film unspools into something kind of much deeper and more poignant than I would have had reason to expect. But in a way, I guess we should start perhaps with the most fundamental question. What prompted you to make a documentary about sidecar dogs?
Well, it didn't happen all at once. My wife, Geneva, and I were working on another film, and we just happened to meet a guy who rode a motorcycle with a sidecar and had this great labradoodle mix of wearing doggles in the sidecar with him. And we thought, you know, this is just a unique opportunity. Let's interview this guy. And he was just so interesting and entertaining and so really deeply connected to the experience of riding with his dog. I mean, this guy could not say enough good about the experience traveling with his dog. So we just sort of walked away from that thinking, it's a fascinating image. It's a entertaining image, makes you smile. The dog in the sidecar. And so we just poked around and found another couple of folks who rode with sidecar dogs, and we interviewed them, and thinking maybe we'll make a short film. And there were just so many things that came up when it came to the human-animal connection and travel and the idea of being on a motorcycle with a dog, which is sort of an odd concept until you really see it. It sort of just evolved, and we decided about a year ago now to try to make a full-length film out of it, and we ended up doing a Kickstarter campaign, and the rest sort of just happened on its own.
Well, that's really cool, because it sounds like how it did unfold was not unlike some of our own experiences. I mean, every so often, I'll see a dog in a sidecar, and I think, wow, that's really cool. And my mother-in-law said, after hearing about today's interview, said when she lived in Toronto, she often saw this beautiful dog in a sidecar with hat and goggles. But, you know, you think at the time, that's just like that one isolated dog in a sidecar. But it sounds like as you started to hit two or three more, you guys realized, hey, there's something here.
Well, you know, when we make documentary films on any range of subjects, we can typically expect about half of the interviews that we do to not even make the film. Part of it is that some people are not comfortable on camera. Some people don't have as interesting a story or a way of communicating the story. And so we typically will expect to throw about half of them out. And in our case, all 18 that we shot made the film, and they were all interesting and of a really high quality and just great people, great stories, and that's unusual. And we started to see that, wait a second, we haven't run across anybody yet that we would eliminate or that was a dead end or a dud. And, you know, we went into it thinking people did this sort of just to look cool. And
yeah.
You get the doggles and the dog. It's just such a great image. And you run to the grocery store, it makes people laugh, and that's it. Really turned out to be more than that. And that's really surprised us. Even though we're dog people, we have a couple of rescue dogs. And we actually have a motorcycle. And for the film, we actually added a sidecar to it just to sort of get that experience. We didn't end up riding with our dogs. And I'll get into that at some point later. But
sure.
It turned out to be such a big deal for these people and for the dogs. The dogs are into it. It's not like they're being compelled into it in any way. These dogs are all, without exception, bouncing off the walls to get into the sidecar, and they seem to love it as much or more than the person did. So those things for us really made us want to find out what drives these people to do it, why they do it, and sort of what the different ins and outs of that experience are.
Yeah, well, as you suggest, hopefully we'll kind of hit each of those things at least to some degree, because I mean there's upwards of 20, I guess you said 18 sidecar folks featured in the film. I mean, I guess that total is when you figure that some dogs or sidecars are shared by a couple rather than an individual.
Right.
But I didn't particularly get the sense that these people knew each other. They clearly have a shared passion, but otherwise I didn't get a sense of any at least sort of discernible connection. Is that correct? And if so, to what extent is that just sort of by design or just the way the filming unfolded?
Well, you know, There are a few people who are connected, but mostly through online forums. And that ended up being our entree into that world. At first, when we decided to look for more sidecar dog riders after the first interview we did, we had a tough time finding these people. You know, like you, we've seen them over the years, you know, here and there. But when you set out to actually try to find somebody who does this, it's tough. And fortunately, we ran into a couple of online forums that have to do with sidecars, people who have these Russian sidecar rigs or people who do long-distance riding, you know, from here to South America, different forums that where people get together and talk about the ins and outs of that. Fortunately, we were able to connect with a few people there. And those online communities are really, really tight. And they do rallies where they'll get together in person a couple times a year. And that was a home run for us when it came to finding three or four of the key people. And then, you know, people, once the word started getting out, once we did the Kickstarter campaign, people started contacting us, which was really, really helpful. And so there were a half a dozen of the folks who I think probably had met in person, but communicated probably on a weekly basis through online forums.
Wow. Well, that, I mean, it's really interesting. So based on your having earlier said that everybody that you interviewed for the film stayed in the film, once you found this online forum, and again, after that, once people started contacting you, was there a particular criteria that you guys used to say, okay, hey, let's interview them? Or was it, hey, so far, everybody we've talked to is fascinating in their own right. Let's just keep going.
Well, when we first started shooting the interviews, I'd say the first seven interviews, we did based on geography, where we were. We're in Western Montana, so somewhat close, a day's drive from us, or places that we were already going to travel for other projects. And so we tried to find people who were accessible without us, you know, buying a plane ticket to go across the country. And so initially it was a little random that way.
It was geography, it sounds like, as much as anything initially.
It was, but then again, you know, we communicated with some people, and it took a while for us to establish some credibility on these forums, because these things are again, a really tight community, and here I had to sign up for a new account, and people could tell I wasn't a longtime member, and writing people random emails saying, hey, I'm making a film about sidecar dogs. A lot of people didn't reply or replied, you know, sort of incredulous way. And and so it took a little while for people to realize, okay, this isn't some weirdo doing a home movie and wants to come to my house with a camera. So we did also, you know, we had a chance to look at photos and try to see, do these people really get out there and ride beyond runs to the grocery store? So we did explore the different options, and in the end, most of the people who volunteered to let us interview them for a day or two, we followed up with. And then later on, we were able to do some traveling and get to different parts of the country.
Yeah, you can see that it kind of does fan out over the course of the film. If you're just tuning in, by the way, I'm speaking with Eric Risto, co-director of the documentary Sit, Stay, Ride, The Story of America's Sidecar Dogs. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Eric a question about sidecar dogs or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. As you were connecting with these people on the forums, and then as they were contacting you after the Kickstarter campaign was initiated, what role, as you got going, did their sidecar dogs being rescue dogs play in being chosen for the film, or was that part of the selection process at all, or was this like, hey, we'll find out about that, but let's just keep talking to people that are interested in us talking to them?
You know, that was an absolutely secondary thing and a real surprise to us. Honestly, we would have followed up with these people. I mean, initially, we didn't know whether they were, you know, from breeders or they were from rescues. Mm-hmm. We asked them during the interview, sort of, what's the history with the dog? And we kept hearing these stories again and again. I went down to the shelter. I went down to the county pound and found these dogs. And we just thought, wow. You know, it was, you know, almost every dog in the film is a rescue of some kind. And we just started to try to draw parallels. Is it because they're motorcyclists, or is it because they're, you know, sort of independent spirits, or what is the connection? We weren't actually able to really pin it down. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, here are, you know, all these motorcyclists, and there's only, out of 15 dogs, there's only a couple that came from, they weren't even necessarily sort of high-end breeders. They were just folks who had a litter of the purebred dog. But most of them are rescues in one form or another. And that really led us to realize, well, wait a second, maybe this is an opportunity to put our feelings about the worth of rescue dogs out there in some form, and maybe use it to help raise some money for some organizations after the film is done, which is what we're trying to do. But that really was coincidental, and it surprised us, truly.
That's really interesting, because, yeah, there really is, as you've kind of noted now, a kind of a strong adoption rescue message running through the movie, and even, in fact, the very first frame of the film says dedicated to all rescue dog, and then there's a beat, and then the rest of the sentence becomes on motorcycles or off. But maybe since we're on this, maybe you should just touch a little bit on how some rescue organizations, you know, can reap some benefits from how the film does and sales of one kind or another.
Well, my wife and I have just had some wonderful, wonderful dogs over the years. They were all rescues, and it was just really, really fun for us to speak with people who felt so passionately about their dogs. And that was a through line, breeder or rescue, as far as the place the dogs came from. These people are so tender and passionate about their dogs and having this relationship with their dogs. And really, in the end, the film is about the human-animal relationship. It happens to be on a motorcycle, but it's just a way to focus on this connection, this true, you know, friendship that exists. And traveling with a person, traveling with a dog, really does seem to create bonds, and shared experiences seem to really create some real depth there. And we will allow any rescue organization that wants to screen the film as a benefit and keep all the proceeds. We'll help try to get the word out. Because there are physical costs to DVDs, et cetera, if folks mm-hmm. want to buy a DVD or a T-shirt or what have you, we send 25% of that to rescue organizations. But we've been delighted that there have been a number of organizations recently that have taken us up on this, and mostly in the West Coast, Portland and San Francisco and San Diego, et cetera. And they've sold out, which is really fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, a theater full of people who are either sidecar and motorcycle fans or dog fans, most likely both, has really made for some fun times. And so, you know, we have an organization that's helping us do these screenings, so you can actually screen it at a local multiplex. You can screen it at an independent theater. It's really kind of a cool thing. And it's, you know, a way that we feel that, you know, in our work as filmmakers, we can somehow try to make some kind of difference. And, you know, it's an issue that's important to us, and it fortunately seems to be an issue that's important to a lot of other folks as well.
Well, we should mention now that the website is sidecardogs.com, where you can find out all kinds of information about hosting a screening and some of the other things that Eric has mentioned. I guess I'd be curious, Eric, because it sounds like really from the very get-go with that first interview or two where you just thought, we don't even know if we have anything, and maybe we have a short, and then obviously you realize, hey, let's keep going with this. But at what point, once you decided to expand your efforts and probably shoot for a feature length, Doc, at what point along the way in the interviewing or in the filming did you realize you had something special here that the whole really did exceed the sum of the parts, as you noted? I mean, it really becomes more about relationships, and as I said kind of earlier in the show, it really becomes kind of a pretty profound, poignant film. I mean, there's themes of freedom and joy and companionship and love and rescue and loyalty. I mean, all kinds of things all sort of coursing through this. Was there a certain point where you thought, wow, this is something more than we thought? This is looked cool, and these guys are great and interesting, colorful characters, but this actually is transcending this now.
You know, it's an interesting question, because my wife and I try to apply the goosebump test, where at some point, if she and I get goosebumps at the same time, we know that something's going on here. And that was really the case in the first interview, because we sat down with Ned Deming, who's the guy who had a wreck on his sidecar with his dog. He's a funny guy, lives in Tacoma, Washington. He used to be an insurance agent. Now it is just his passion to ride in sidecars, and he's kind of known as sort of the godfather of sidecar riding in the Northwest. You know, he helps people get into it. And we both had goosebumps talking to this guy, because anytime a story totally goes beyond our expectations, we thought we were going to hear about how he puts goggles on the dog and goes, you know, down to a friend's house or a grocery store or what have you. And as you said, it went into so many more issues that were so much more, you know, personal. And anytime you have, you know, a grown person brought to tears talking about something on their own accord, without us prodding and trying to get them into an emotional state, there's something going on there.
Yeah.
It's important to them. And the importance and the real meaning to him, as we talked about him riding with his dog, really caught our attention. And so as I think we knew we had something day one, whether it be a short film or whatever. And then as we proceeded onward, there wasn't one interview that didn't have that same kind of vibe, whether it be in the same vein or slightly different. So as we went along, we just thought, you know, we could probably keep shooting these interviews and make a 13-part series for television because it just didn't end. And, you know, the stories were varied. You know, there were really interesting elements to it. And we talked about maybe doing a sequel, but, you know, in looking for people across the country, there was a range of personalities or a range of backgrounds. We did our very best to find any racial diversity, and we were unable to. And still have been unable to, and I'm not sure why that is. It's probably just due to the fact that not everybody in the world is on a forum. You know, we're a little limited that way. But, you know, the diversity of people and their backgrounds and personalities is interesting, but also the similarities and the reasons that they love to do what they do are very, very similar. And I love that, where you have different people saying a lot of the same things. I think that's, you know, kind of gives a sense of a community.
Just to sort of pick up with what you said about Ned Deming, because again, as you said, he had a wreck. And when he describes something went awry with, I guess it was the front part or the steering part of his sidecar rig, and he was out with his dog Kirby, as I recall. And he describes this accident, and it's pretty horrible because he flips, and as he keeps talking, you realize, wow, this was a very, very serious accident. So he's really describing it, of course, very calmly, because it turns out, luckily, of course, he's okay later. But he talks about the thing flipping and that the sidecar ends up virtually on top of him, and that Kirby, he's of course worried immediately about Kirby, and that Kirby, he sees Kirby, Kirby is fine, and so like looking at him like, hey, what's next? And there's something where he says, I don't have the exact wording, but it's something he says like, was when he thinks, hey, he really is in deep trouble in terms of the severity of the accident. If I had to go this way, that'd be pretty good. I'd be okay with that. And then I was like, wow, that is, oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, so powerful. And which reminds me of another thing I thought was also really powerful emotionally. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the gentleman who has the trunk lid dedicated to Lance Corporal Colton Rusk, which I also thought was just very, very poignant.
You know, it's interesting that the gentleman you're referring to, the rider, his name is J.D. Whitaker. He's actually the first sidecar dog rider we met, but we didn't have a chance to interview him. We were in San Francisco and happened upon a vintage motorcycle ride. There were about 150 people on old motorcycles, and here's a guy with a dog and a sidecar. And of course, I went up to him, said hello, and he gave me his business card, which actually was his dog's business card, and I kept that, and fortunately I did. In the time, a couple years went by, you know, until we were actually making the film, and I got a hold of him. He'd moved to North Carolina. J.D. Whitaker was a veteran. He was in the Air Force back in the 70s and has ridden sidecars for years and years. And at present, he rides with a boxer named Hercules, and their mission is to travel the country on what's called the Tour of Honor, where you go from Veterans Memorial to Veterans Memorial, and sometimes it's used to raise money for veterans organizations by doing this. And he's ridden 40,000 miles with Hercules over the years. And he has painted the trunk lid of his sidecar with a memorial to a young Marine named Colton Rusk, as you mentioned, who was 20 years old when killed a few years ago in Afghanistan. He was a dog handler, and they used a Labrador named Eli to find roadside bombs. And Eli and Colton were so good at it that they were targeted for assassination by a sniper. And the dog, who was healthy and fine and unharmed, was actually given to Colton Rusk's family, which my understanding from JD is that has never happened in the history of the Marine Corps. And so that story really caught JD's attention, and JD was looking for someone to, you know, to ride in name of. And so whenever people come out of gas stations or out of parks or places to come over and take pictures of the dog, which happens all the time with these people, JD asks people to also take a picture of the trunk lid with Colton's memorial on it and place that on Facebook, on social media, as well as a picture of his dog. And in doing so, there's literally thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures of Hercules on one hand and then Colton Rusk's memorial on another. So that sort of riding with his dog for a higher purpose, something that really resonated with us.
Yeah.
JD's a remarkable guy. He's just I think, a fabulous representative of not only motorcyclists, but folks representing rescue dogs.
At one point in a different part of the film, he says, just talking about sort of the sidecar dog experience, you keep wondering why they haven't made this against the law. It's so much fun. And that's, that's another, really, striking thing. Because watching the film, it is sort of irresistible and infectious. And I found myself attracted to the sidecar dog world. I think, hey, I'd like to do that. I've never been a motorcycle guy, and I don't currently have a dog that I think would be interested in it, frankly. But you think, wow, it's just hard not to be sort of mesmerized and drawn to it.
Well, sidecars are just such a wonderful relic of early 20th century transportation. They were just a practical thing. It was initially a wicker basket on a wheel that they attached to an early 1900s era motorcycle, and just for put one person on the back and a kid on the tank and a couple people in the sidecar, and it was just very practical. And I don't know when the first dog ended up in a sidecar, but I have a photo that unfortunately we could not get the rights to use in the film. But this motorcycle was pegged as an early 1920s model. I'm sure that it wasn't long after someone invented the sidecar that someone thought to put their pooch in there. And I think that's just it's a wonderful thing to consider that's probably been going on for 100 years. And it is. It's just so much fun. As I mentioned, we actually added a sidecar onto an old BMW motorcycle that we have. And it really, I thought perhaps it would be a through line to our film. Us building the sidecar rig and training our dogs to be in the sidecar and then having them ride happily into the sunset. And it just didn't work out that way. And that's the reality of this thing, is that not every dog's comfortable. And I bought a sidecar that was too low, actually. It was cut low enough that as we would try to go around a corner, the dogs felt exposed. They were sitting up too high, and they felt like they were going to fall out, and even with a harness. So I learned a lesson on that, and maybe with a bigger sidecar like some of these folks in the film use, maybe they would be into it. But it was sort of an unfortunate dead end as far as a narrative element of our film. But, one aspect of this that really caught my attention was that people take incredible care to make sure their dog is safe.
Yeah.
And, Ned's story about this accident sounds scary, but in fact, Kirby was attached in with a harness, but Ned had put so much thought into how to keep Kirby safe that he put a clip in between the harness and the leash that attaches him into the sidecar, a clip that would break at a certain weight threshold. So he knew that if Kirby tried to chase a squirrel or a deer, that he wouldn't be able to get out of the sidecar. But in the extreme force of a crash, that clip would break and the dog would be thrown clear, which was what happened. And Kirby was completely safe. So that is another element that surprised us, that everybody in the film has really thought out the safety and comfort of their dogs. Put a lot of time and sometimes money into that.
Yeah, they really, many of them describe that in some detail, which was not surprising based as you start to get to know these people, but it was still comforting to know that there was that much emphasis placed on making sure no matter what that they were safe. And some of them are right along in sidecars in some fairly serious weather conditions, lots of snow and other things. That's one of the things, too. By the way, again, my guest is Eric Risto. He and his wife, Geneva, have made a new documentary, Sit, Stay, Ride, The Story of America's Sidecar Dogs. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. And the film's website is sidecardogs.com. But yeah, there's, of course, a lot in the film about the how the various humans feel and just the connection and the impact. What's also cool is that we also hear, or at least a sense of the impact on the dogs. And not only that they're, in almost all cases, totally eager and excited the minute there's even the prospect of there being a sidecar ride, but at least one describes how the dog has one different personality sort of just day to day, and then the minute there's a sidecar ride introduced, becomes arrogant, even, which I loved, and like it boosts his confidence. And I thought, wow, that's
pretty funny.
Yeah, But I mean, you could really see it too, as you start to see them out on these rides and just what happens. And they just, some of them get kind of puffed up and they're just so excited. And but yeah, there's almost like a, in some cases, sort of a visible transformation.
It's true. They just seem to take on sort of a regal state, and whether they're mesmerized by the cascade of smells coming down the road, or whether they are, you know, really thinking they're hot stuff, it's impossible to say, but they, dogs really seem to enjoy it.
And yeah.
I think if you've ever seen a dog with the head out the window of the car and how much they love that, imagine that in 360, you know, where
yeah.
you've got, you know, completely open space around you. Sometimes there's a little windscreen, sometimes there isn't, but it's pretty amazing to think about the experience for the dog. I mean, it's so much fun riding a motorcycle or, you know, even a convertible car with, as a human, but with a dog being able to smell and hear so much more, it must be really pretty neat.
Well, that's the thing, because they talked about the incredible, because it is so much better and more exposed, obviously, than riding in a car. So yeah, a lot of them really talked about the sense of smell and how the dogs, of course, are just like, just can't get enough of it, and just their noses are going crazy from the minute they start on the ride. But also, yeah, just the experience. Some of them have that windshield, but many of them have the what I've come to learn are not goggles, but doggles. And and again, that just, you know, gives them that kind of jaunty look. But yeah, it's pretty great. Let me read one of our emailers here. It says, this is fascinating. I never knew that this existed. How does one know if a dog would be interested in riding in a sidecar? Is there training involved?
We were told by a number of riders that if your dog likes to ride in the car and put their window out and put their head out the window, that they'll most likely love the motorcycle. Now, some dogs that are spooked by loud noises may not enjoy it. You know, some motorcycles are louder than the others. Speaking of sort of safety and comfort, one guy actually quieted down his Harley for the sake of the dog's ears. He just thought, you know, that's got to be too tough on a sensitive set of ears. But, you know, there are folks who said to us that their dog jumped right in, put on the harness and went down the highway, and there was no training involved. But other folks, particularly a couple in Cincinnati who have a long and extensive history training dogs, really took great care to make sure that their dogs were comfortable and well-trained, and went through a process of putting the dog in the sidecar while it's just sitting there. Put the dog in the sidecar and then give some positive reinforcement, some treats. And then put the dog in the sidecar a couple of days later and just push it around the backyard with no engine noise. And, you know, then running the engine and sitting still and just getting the dog comfortable to the space and creating positive associations there. And didn't seem to take long before the dog was completely comfortable going down the road. I really think, just as it would be with people on motorcycles, you know, varying levels of comfort or complete discomfort, it's going to vary dog to dog.
Yeah,
but I think a good measure tends to be, if your dog loves to travel, would be in the back of the car, you know, head out the window. It's a good sign.
Good candidate. Yeah, and I think it was even JD I'm pretty sure it was him, but talked about, like, at this point, I think Hercules was his third sidecar dog, and it sounded like two out of the three were very eager, enthusiastic sidecar riders, and I guess maybe the one in between those three, not so much. So again, that's just sort of dog to dog, I guess.
Yep, that's right. And I think that really, from what we saw, most people, you know, have had you know, one or two sidecar dogs, maybe three, and most of the dogs were interested and excited to do it. And occasionally, you heard about a dog that just wasn't excited. And that is one element to rescue dogs: is you don't know their past. And they could have experiences and have preferences based on past, you know, their past life that could affect that. And, you know, I think more often than not, the dog is ready to do what their human friend wants to do. And especially being outside and traveling, that really seems to connect with dogs in general.
Sure. Well, it's got a lot to offer most dogs. I mean, all the kind of things they love are rolled into one sidecar outing, pretty much. So, Eric, we're just kind of nearing the end of our time here, but what is there anything in particular that you would want people who have had an opportunity to see the film to sort of take away from it? Again, as we've talked about, there's way more depth and way more sort of themes and messages to it than people might have, you know, have reason to assume if they either haven't seen it at all or just seen a clip or seen the story on the NBC Nightly News, et cetera. But is there anything you and Geneva are sort of hoping that people will take away from it overall?
Well, there are a couple things, and one of them is that it's something that's pretty marvelous, is that thanks to the internet, people with strange little hobbies can find each other. Didn't used to be the case. You know, if you rode on a sidecar with a dog, chances are you're never going to meet another one, or you might, maybe on the coast of California, a few places where you have a few more than you do in other locations. But people with the most esoteric hobbies can now form a community. And I think that's neat, because people have passions, and sometimes those passions are not real common. And so to be able to form communities and then actually form, you know, friendships offline is very, very neat. And we have seen similarly that a community is formed around the film, and it's allowed people who find it interesting or find it to be a passion to share it in a very wide way. And fortunately, with our subject matter, dogs and sidecars, you know, it touches on a very, very common interest and passion, which is dogs, and which is, you know, that human-animal relationship. And so we've just been just really honored by the reception of the film and how people have, you know, sort of adopted the film as a way to help highlight the human-animal relationship, but also the bonds that can be created through travel and shared experience, really, whether it's human-to-human or human-to-animal. And that's been really neat for us to see.
For sure. Well, that's well said, and probably exactly the perfect place to leave it. So we've been speaking with Derek Risto, again, the co-director with his wife Geneva of Sit, Stay, Ride, the story of America's sidecar dogs. The website is sidecardogs.com, and you can see some of the dogs and people we're talking about. You can figure out if you'd like to host a screening or just get a copy of the film. All those things or more are provided at that website. So, Eric, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals, and I guess needless to say, I really, really enjoyed the film.
Duncan, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. In a minute, we'll have a brief chat with Dr. Stephen Tauber, a professor at the University of South Florida, who tonight is delivering a lecture entitled Law, Politics, and Animal Rights. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Nick DiPaolo with a piece called Animal Activists on today's Comedy Corner. Talking Animals.
I'm sick of activists. Everybody's a goddamn activist in Los Angeles. Everybody's like an animal activist. I love animals too. But, you know, if I see one more person walking a dog with a coat on it, I'm going to stab him. I swear to God. That's the first sign of mental illness. You start dressing up your pets, okay? Take the snorkel jacket off the chihuahua. The dog was born with a coat. He doesn't need another one. It's like giving an alligator false teeth. Leave him alone. On the lawn, he licks his own balls. Let's buy him a tweed jacket. We don't even have kennels now. We have doggy hotels in this country. Did you see this? We got people sleeping on the streets in this country, yet somewhere there's a poodle pissed off because a maid didn't leave a liver snap on his pillow last night. I got a lady that lives next to me that talks to her pets like she thinks they're human. She's yelling at her dog last week. She's going, "Did you hear what I said? Did you hear what I said?" I go, "You know, I think his hearing's perfect. It's the English language that's throwing him off a tad. Maybe he can't hear you because he's wearing earmuffs and a hat."
That was Nick DiPaolo with a piece called Animal Activists, taken from his album Born This Way. Right now, to discuss a lecture he'll be delivering this evening entitled Law, Politics, and Animal Rights, let's welcome Dr. Stephen Tauber to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Tauber.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's find out a little bit about your role at USF, what you teach and what you do, and we'll go from there.
Okay, well, I've been there since 1995 as a professor in the Department of Government and International Affairs, and I teach classes in American politics, quantitative analysis, classes on the courts, classes on interest groups. And since 2012, I've been the chair of the department, and my term will end in 2017. So I've been doing a little less teaching and more administration. And for the last 10 years or so, my research has focused on animal advocacy issues and the politics of animal advocacy issues.
And that makes me wonder, if does USF offer any sort of animal advocacy class or even a minor in that field?
Unfortunately, not that I'm aware of. If I have an opportunity, perhaps as I'm exiting administration and going back into full-time teaching, I might consider developing a class for at least for the political science major and try to make it apply to other majors as well.
Sure.
We do have classes on food security and food and politics, but not specifically on the politics of animal advocacy.
It just seemed like given your own interest and just the growing number of campuses that are offering at least classes and sometimes minors and sometimes even majors in that field,
yes,
that might be a possibility at some
point.
Yeah,
something worth developing. I mean, unfortunately, you know, we have so many majors and so many students that, you know, we just need to make sure we cover the basics first,
sure,
get them out, graduate them on time. So, but it's
right,
definitely something I'd like to do.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about tonight's lecture, which is entitled Law, Politics, and Animal Rights.
So it's going to be a portion of a book that I'm publishing. It's forthcoming in the spring of this year, published by Paradigm, which is a kind of a academic press that focuses on social sciences and humanities. And the book is called Navigating the Jungle, Law, Politics, and the Animal Advocacy Movement. And it's really the first animal law book that looks at an empirical analysis of animal law. All the research and scholarship most thus far focuses more on normative, what we should do for animals, or doctrinal, how the laws develop. Mine's an empirical approach that looks specifically at the influence of politics on animal law outcomes. And my lecture is going to focus on a chapter from that book that looks at the effect that litigation, particularly animal advocacy litigation, has on media coverage of animal advocacy issues. The chapter has some quantitative analysis, which I'm not going to focus on during my lecture. Instead, I'm going to do a comparative case study of PETA's suit a couple of years ago on behalf of Tillicum, that used the 13th Amendment, that did not receive favorable coverage, did not change the conversation on animal advocacy issues and animal rights and the plight of orcas. It was more lampooning PETA and kind of focusing more on PETA's publicity seeking and the kind of comparison of orcas and slaves. And I'm going to compare that to the non-human rights project that Steve Wise is currently running, that is seeking to litigate on behalf of chimpanzees using state court and using state court common law. And that's actually changed the national conversation on animal rights. He was on the Colbert Report. He's been on NPR. About 8-9 months ago, the New York Times Magazine had a cover story on it. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I am part of that project. I'm one of the leading social science consultants, but I'm going to compare how sort of the nature of the suit and the reputation of the organization filing the suit affects how the media covers animal advocacy issues after cases are litigated. And there's a long history of that in the animal rights movement. There's a famous case from the 1980s where the Animal Legal Defense Fund sued a gourmet food company about over veal production. And even though they lost the suit, they still kind of changed the national conversation on how veal is produced and the horrors of the veal calves. And so I'm going to focus on that for my lecture.
Well, it sounds really interesting because, I mean, first of all, the PETA suit on behalf of Tillicum, of course, blackfish totally changed the Tillicum and related pictures, but still there's the matter of Lolita and some of the same kind of issues swirling around that. But yeah, Stephen Wise was on this show, and one of the things we did talk about is just even, I mean, he's been at this in one form or another for decades, just even the way that he kind of charted the evolution of the seriousness with which his efforts were taken more recently compared to early on, and all the folks like yourself and many others, all kinds of lawyers, obviously, who have joined forces. And then, the New York Times piece. But even in the New York Times piece, they were pointing out that there are people that still find it hard to take him seriously. And yet the advances, it's hard to snicker at those. I mean, he's really making inroads.
Absolutely. And to make it perfectly clear, I'm not arguing that the NHRP suit, the Non-Human Rights Project suit, will change everybody's mind. But it's opened up a very serious discussion, public discussion about animal rights, and the PETA suit did not do that. You know, there's a very scathing Daily Show episode where Wyatt Cenac interviewed people from PETA, and instead of talking about the terrible plight of orcas in captivity, which I'm completely opposed to and I think is wrong and should be ended as a matter of public policy, they're focusing more about sort of PETA's publicity seeking, and again using the 13th Amendment was very unfortunate because it's a, you know, it's a kind of an archetype of our civil rights history, and probably, you know, has this vaulted status that should not be used for anything else but ending slavery for African Americans.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've had an idea for a show or two rolling around in my head that really looks at PETA and sort of the virtues and the minuses, and in some ways what you're describing here is really a crux of sort of what I've been pondering, because I just think a lot of what they're doing is sort of anachronistic kind of buffoonery, and yet at times they're still doing some good effective work. And I go to conferences and I meet like these young PETA lawyers and other people who I'm gigantically impressed with, but sometimes the disparity is just enormous. And like you say, the zeal for publicity and stuff can also, you know, make them incredibly hard to take seriously, or just make them ripe for mocking.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, all right. So, you know, what we haven't actually touched on, Dr. Tauber, is exactly where the lecture is being offered tonight.
So it's going to be at 7 p.m. at the Jimmy B. Keel Library, which is up on Bears in between, I guess, like Rome and Del Mabry, maybe. It's part of the College of Arts and Sciences. They're doing what they call the ROAD, R-O-A-D, Scholar Lecture Series, where different faculty will present their research, not within the university, but out on the road, kind of showing the public the kinds of work we're doing and how it relates to issues that they care about.
And is that is it at 8 o'clock or?
7 o'clock.
10 o'clock?
7, I'm sorry.
Oh, 7, sorry, okay.
7, yes.
Right, okay, cool. So, and people can just turn up at that if they're...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they want an RSVP, but I think their people can just come if they're interested. If they're listening to the show now,
yeah,
they could come to the lecture, and I'm pretty sure have a significant opportunity for questions and answers, and I could explain more on my research and certainly more on other aspects of the book that I'm not going to cover at the lecture.
Sure. Well, two quick things before I let you go, Dr. Tauber. One is, can you repeat the title of the book again? I wanted it for myself, and actually I have an emailer here asking the same question.
Okay, so it's Navigating the Jungle, Law, Politics, and the Animal Advocacy Movement.
Cool. And you say that's out in spring?
Yeah, late spring. So it's been accepted. It was sent out for review, and reviewers liked it, and I made changes based on reviewer comments, and so now it's going into production, and you know, sometimes it's hard to predict, but I'm expecting May or June.
Okay. Well, needless to say, I'd love to have you come in and have a full-length interview about the book at that point.
Oh, absolutely. I'd be thrilled to.
Great. All right, Dr. Tauber, well, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Bye-bye now.
Okay, well, take care.
You too.
Bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, now rolling into the noon hour, so it constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune today, I'll be offering a pocket monkey. We'll get into that in a moment here on Talking Animals. Right now, let's do a quick moment or two of animal news and announcements. Friends of Strays invites you to find your true love at their Valentales open house this Saturday, February 14th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can see their updated shelter facilities, meet adoptable animals, take a picture with your pet, pooch, smooch, and kitty kiss booths. Wow! Ask a certified vet tech some questions, and you can get a discounted adoption fee for certain cats. So that's happening at Friends of Strays this Saturday. And looking ahead, a little bit different thing. On Monday, February 16th, there is an exhibit coming to Pasco County Fairgrounds called Butterfly and Blooms. Butterfly exhibit, which includes different species of butterflies, host and nectar plants, flowers, etc. And you can observe sort of the whole butterfly life cycle. So that's at Pasco County Fairgrounds from noon to 9 p.m. this Monday, the 16th. I think it's there for a few days. I think that's when it opens, and it's there, sounds like, through the 22nd. So, yeah, I think that's it for now. Let's get into Name That Animal Tune. You're listening to Talk Animals, and the show website is talkanimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, your very own pocket monkey. That's right. You heard about it hopefully during a fun drive. If not, you'll find out soon enough. To the first person that calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's named an animal tune on Talking Animals. We'll probably need to take any guesses offline. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Loy again is up next with what amounts to 2 hours, really, of one kind or another radioactivity, so that's great. I'll be back next Wednesday, February 18th, with a special edition of Talking Animals. In this case, special edition may not be an empty cliche, in that last weekend I traveled to Austin and interviewed Temple Grandin on stage at the 1,200-seat Paramount Theater. Over the years, I've interviewed Dr. Grandin 4 times on Talking Animals, but this represented the first in-person extended conversation we've had. So on next week's show, I'll air about half of that conversation, with the other half coming somewhere down the line in the near future. So I hope you'll join me for part one of my conversation with Temple Grandin next Wednesday on Talking Animals. Also, hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter. And also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news, fascinating news sometimes even, from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi and beyond, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. If you didn't get a chance to donate to our fund drive, but even if you did, go to WMNF.org. Throw us a few more bucks, would you? We're almost to our goal, and we'd love to make it all the way to the finish line. All right, we'll speak to you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.